Thanks. This is my own introduction always, throw that up. Nice old building. It's old on the outside, anyway, modern on the inside there. Armagh Observatory, right on the, 20 miles from the border in the north of Ireland. Okay. And this is the other part of my introduction always. Star formation. Formation of a low mass star. Try to put it into these eight stages here. And well, with turbulence, in particular supersonic turbulence, I organize myself here a bit. We often hear a lot about the interpretation of molecular bulk. That's a big
the only really big one I got. That's good enough.
About the first four stages, we observe in, say, the carbon monoxide line, we observe the mass and velocity of gas in the interstellar medium. And there we see diffuse clouds and molecular clouds in these first four stages towards the collapse of a low-mass star. And from that, or from similar data with the interstellar medium, we try to work out how supersonic turbulence seems to behave. What I'll be doing today is something rather different. I'll be looking at the latter stages in the star formation process. Just at this stage here, where you've formed some sort of hydrostatic core here, a class zero protostar, is where we get these very powerful jets. At this early stage, the molecular jets, you have this accretion disk still around it, and so you can't actually see the class zero protostar itself. Perhaps in the radio you can see something at that stage. But the jets actually are the trumpets which signal the formation of a star, the actual moment of birth. And then later on, you go through the other stages as we approach the pre-main sequence star over here, and the jets seem to change from being mainly molecular to being mainly atomic, and some of their properties also change. And I've spent quite a lot of time looking at those jets, but now, able to do that in more detail, we can also look at the turbulence which surrounds the jets. And that's the idea of this whole project, or half the project at least. The sort of object from which we can get data is one like this, HH212, often called the most beautiful jet. This is an infrared image. So the star is at least seen in the radio, is right there. And here we're seeing the infrared molecular hydrogen emission. So you're really just seeing the shock waves, where the gas is heated to a 1000 or 2000 Kelvin will you see much emission. And so that's what we're seeing here. And so we see several bullets, we see bow shocks, and then over here you see something much more turbulent in this direction. Over here you see mainly the bow shocks. So if you look at it, just see the strongest emission, like in here, you tend to see a more laminar flow, you tend to see bow shocks, you tend to see shock configurations. The scale of this picture would be about, or 212, I think it's about a parsec in length there. So it's, I don't know, a few hundred arc seconds long, at least. 200 arc seconds long. What they've actually done is actually resolve the jet in this direction. It's a few arc seconds transverse there. And we actually observe that the jet seems to be rotating. There's also a molecular disk in here which we see rotating in the same direction. This is the first object where we actually think that we're observing the purpose of the jets, because we believe we've observed the jet rotation, and that's the purpose of the jets is to carry away the angular momentum so the star can form. And here, with infrared spectroscopy, we see a systematic change in velocity transverse to the jet there, and we believe it's the first evidence that the jets are indeed carrying away the angular momentum. That's not the... Sorry, what's halfway through? Where exactly? Yeah, it's a pulsated jet. There's lots of bullets being thrown out here, and these individual bullets seem to be creating individual bow shocks. So, if I put it up, for example, so there are several bow shocks. We just look at one side. Then there seems to be this bow shock at the end, here. And then here there seems to be a double bow shock. And then these objects here, is also, this one here, for example, is bow-shaped. These tend to be more like little knots, very hard to see if they're bows or not. Here you can see this is also bow-shaped going in the opposite direction. Is that what you mean? Yeah, well, the turbulence at the other end. It depends what's driving the turbulence. If it's coming after the, say, the jet has hit the interstellar medium, and then in the shell which forms, you would expect that shell to be turbulent, and then you would some sort of turbulent structure. But also if the jet is interacting with a cloud or an external medium halfway along, it could also. That's true. In here there's a bow shock here. It's gone that far. But there seems to be some kind of turbulent region in here. And there seems to be some turbulence here also. Could well be. Sorry, there's... In this case, there seems to be a series of bullets, and it looks as though some of them, or one of them has reached, for example, here, but it's now fading, it's not being driven by the jet anymore, and then other stronger bullets are now being ejected at this moment. I've actually seen acceleration here, quite a uniform acceleration. The velocity increases as you go out there, along here, this side, and also along this side, besides the rotation. It appears as though it was something like an explosion 1,000 years ago, which has produced almost simultaneously the whole structure, this inner structure, because of that acceleration. We see acceleration in several jets like that. The acceleration there is... must be... 3,000 AU, I guess. Must be about 10 to the 16 centimeters, maybe 10 to the 17 centimeters over that inner jet. The speed is quite close to the plane of the sky, and it appears to be about 100 kilometers a second deep projected. It's only a few kilometers a second radial. And we don't have any proper motions of it as yet. Not for this particular jet. Why do I don't. It looks a bit turbulent. That's what I should say. We'd like to know. It looks as though it's quite turbulent there. It could be lots of little bow shocks all muddled up there. And we can call that supersonic turbulence if we like. But yes, I mean, the idea is to quantify this and see what type of turbulent structure or chaotic structure it is there, and what's driving it. So I might see some of the other knots. Yeah, absolutely right, yes. And that does seem to be the case in Cepheus A, which I'll be showing in a minute. It does seem to break up. This is another one, the Dragon Jet HH-288. Also shows a similar sort of structures in there. Bow shots plus much more disordered structure. Okay. And then, see, we always use the orange there because it's much easier to see it against the black And the first supersonic jet to be observed, we actually painted orange so we could observe it, and that was Chuck Yeager's, who was the first person to go faster than the speed of sound. So I always love to show that, the fact that it's also painted orange. It's pure coincidence. Okay, so just to... I want to keep on the track of my notes here before I go off in the wrong direction. So with these, what we can really observe is the shock waves.
We can also observe the mass and the velocity in the CO and the submillimeter, but really we can observe the shock waves. And the nice thing about the outflows is that they're very intense. So because you have such high supersonic speeds and they're in jets, it's collimated, it's a really good laboratory really to test what we know about supersonic turbulence.
So we have to model, but then we have, that means we have to model the shock waves, which means we have to know some physics of the shocks, so things can get complicated. What it started to do a few years ago was to not model the turbulence, we just wanted to model the jets. So we took a Zeus type code, and we introduced the molecules, and the molecules are allowed to dissociate, but we didn't have that much resolution here. No resolution to really look at the supersonic turbulence there. So it's basically ejecting bullets. These are just five different populations near the endpoints, just showing the density that you would get for a ballistic jet, an overdense jet. But as I said, it's low resolution, and what actually happens is in these bow shocks at the end, there is a complete mixing between the two media, between the jet and this external gas. Right in this bow shock, we expect that really high vorticity to be created and turbulence to be created. There's basically very little in here because the shock is much too thin, and just over a couple of grid zones, the two are just really mixed together. Actually, it turns out it explains the observations very beautifully, this perfect mixing. It does really explain what we see in the CO outflow quite well quantitatively, which is a surprise, but maybe it's telling you something about the way nature is working there with that mixing. It's three-dimensional, fully three-dimensional. The boundary conditions where the jet begins, in the top case, is basically just a switch on there. And in these cases where we have a pulsations introduced, it is a sinusoidal pulsation is introduced. Try to introduce it smoothly, not to give it enough an enormous shock. That's what we really want to test out here. At the moment, this looks good in general at describing the very large scale structure, because we actually, from the densities, we actually reproduce the infrared images, just like I was just showing you an infrared, and that's what they look like. They look absolutely nothing like the density maps I just showed you. They actually, you just see the shocks in this hot gas, and then you see something. Two of these simulations looks quite like this H212. We don't have the acceleration in the jet here. We haven't modeled everything as yet, but it looks quite promising in the general structure observed. You can also see just a bit there, some of the turbulence we're starting to get in here, but only on the large scale structure. But when it has a bit of space to breathe there, you do start to get some turbulent looking shock structures there. And we're working on that now, and that'll be the next stage after what I've shown you today, in looking at different types of turbulence. And one of the things we've gone on to do is to get a higher resolution, have a box which just follows along the end of the jet, and to look at that main bow shock there. And we start to see that the bow shock starts to break up into other little mini bow shocks. And in principle, we can now count up the number of shocks in this simulation and then compare that with what we would with what we actually can observe. We
The question really is how to do that. How can we really count up what we observe? Yes, they're all into the quiescent medium there. Well, what? Yes, so, yes, there's a purely hydrodynamic there. Sorry? There is very little observation of magnetic field at all in outflows. There's only one or two cases where there happened to be an extragalactic radio, a radio galaxy behind there, and then we're able to say something about the magnetic field strength through the Faraday rotation. And so that gives us some idea, and it's... That's one way, and it gives a reasonable feel. By reasonable, I mean it gives an Alpine speed of about 1 or 2 kilometers per second, what we expect typically in molecular clouds. In other cases where we know something about the shock physics, that can the magnetic field then also tends to widen the shocks, thicken the shocks. So we can then estimate the magnetic field from how thick we see these shocks. If they were hydrodynamic, they would be extremely thin. But we do see them extended, and that gives us an idea that the Alpine speed is probably a few kilometers a second. When you're looking at an infrared image, like this infrared image, you are basically, if you've subtracted the continuum, so you've just got the line emission, then you are only seeing shocks. The gas has to be heated to what above 1,000 Kelvin to be able to see it. And that can only happen in a shock, because at that temperature, it would immediately cool back down if it's not continually collisionally excited. So we're certain here that we are definitely observing shocks. If it was fluctuations, it wouldn't be able to heat it up to such a temperature. Wouldn't be able to maintain it at a temperature like that at all. Now this is HH12, the most famous Herbig-Haro objects. They were originally all optical, now we see them in the infrared. And so, as I said, if we can't count the shocks very well until we've got a better resolution and have some, make a few assumptions, we can do spectroscopy. And given the shock distribution, we would expect that to produce different strengths for all the different hydrogen lines. And then if we are observing supersonic turbulence, we should be able to test that against what the observations are showing us. So what we do, for example, in this case, we put slits. This is with data from EarthSpec at ESO. And put slits along the outflow. Describe something here. Star is sitting about here. This is HH1. There's also this Cohen-Schwarz star here. But here we see a bow shock around here, not very clear on this image. This is just the infrared image, molecular hydrogen again. Here it looks much more turbulent. Space telescope pictures which show a whole lot of little bow shocks and turbulent structures, turbulent-like structures in there. We've actually been observing this a bit more deeply very recently. This is work with Chris Davis and Jochen Eislerfel, trying to get some data to interpret. So there's HH1, the top there. You can see the star, the common star crosses there. And you again see the green is the iron line, so it's the Fe2 line. So you need to be partly ionized to get that emission. And you see the bow shock up here, and then possibly in the wake of the bow shock, you see the molecular hydrogen emission. Also in the jet, here's the star, extinction here, you can't see anything. But then you see it quite highly excited because it's green, it's the iron jet here. There are several knots in there. And then after that, you see the jet only in the molecular hydrogen line. it seems as though the excitation in the jet is getting weaker as you go along it there, and you end up from exciting it to 10,000 Kelvin, you're only exciting the gas to about 1,000 Kelvin along the jet there. So they could describe that as some form of decaying turbulence as you go out along the jet is one possibility there. And we want to be able to test if that is reasonable or not, depending on how fast turbulence would decay. Yeah, there's stuff over there. That must be another outflow. And HH144, there's three knots over here. I think it's this lower one could be driving this structure. These regions get very complicated, and there tend to be more and more outflows the deeper you look. And it can be very difficult to divide up. It could also be that this structure here is not related to HH1 and 2. It could also be driven by some other protostar, maybe somewhere near here, we think. Often, proper motions can be the best way to find out what's going on.
Do they have the same distance from us? Are they actually both? Are they not in the same molecular?
These will all be in the same molecular cloud, from experience. It tends to be a star formation cloud, and they're all in there. Yeah. Right. Yeah. 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 Oh, yes. There are lots. The HH110, for example, has two types like that, and the actual driving stars are only about 1,000 AU apart. That's true. It's not simply there's any uniform or large scale magnetic field is controlling the direction. That's totally wrong. Yeah. That's true.
Well, I'm not sure anyone quibbles on whether it's closed or whether it's
true that the magnetic field is not imposed there. It's going to be actually due to the angular momentum winding up whatever field you have there. So the magnetic field gets imposed effectively by the angular momentum. And then the angular momentum must, as Jim said, have some small-scale structure, or reasonably small-scale structure, so that it's small-scale enough, might just collapse a bit.
Could you guess that the transfer disk might be doing that independently of what the weak field orientation was?
Yeah.
You grab it and you use it.
Yeah.
Yes, that's... Right, yes. Yeah, that is true. And some of these shocks are quite thick, which would suggest you could have quite a high alpha instead as well, 10 or 20 kilometers a second. Could also be consistent. Can't rule out that. So yeah, the alpha number might be quite low. The particle density in these outflows tends to vary, but for example, the atomic or molecular densities would be 10 to the 4 in this object, and 10 to the 6, 10 to the 7 even in some of the other outflows, especially from the higher mass stars. Yes. Yeah. But it depends what you say. A strong, yes. And it's coming from a star there where you've probably got up to a kilogauss field around it. You probably have about a kilogauss field to drive the jets there in the first place. Now with an alpha number of close to unity, right at where the jets begin. So actually the alpha number must actually increase at least a bit along the jet there, so that it's super alphanic. And
in order for the jet to be
first thing comes in my head is 10 to the minus 3 solar masses per bullet. That might be a bit of a for example, if those things are being ejected every 100 years, and if the mass outflow rate on average is 10 to the minus 6 solar masses per year, so then there would be 10 to the minus 4 solar masses per bullet swept up into each bullet. Okay, so with that ground-based data, we're observing the stronger shocks, which I was trying to show in the HH1 and 2 picture just now, and then we can do this, as I said, with spectroscopy. A very quick description of what we do here. With the molecular hydrogen, with the hydrogen molecule, you can rotate and vibrate, and here from the ground in the K-band we see the vibrations in various transitions, and the transition's energy comes from this upper state, which can be thousands of kelvins up to tens of thousands of kelvin. And there can be quite a few lines we can observe. So we can observe the column of gas to produce the lines, and we can plot that against the upper energy level of that transition. So this is the upper energy level,
TJ. And here, we don't just simply plot the column, because if it's close to thermodynamic equilibrium, it's, the columns would be exponential with temperature, and then you can't see anything because it's such a wide exponential over this range of temperatures. So I normalize it into what I call a column density ratio. You just divide it by what you would expect if the gas was at 2000 Kelvin. It's the way it's become the standard to analyze these things. So that's what I present here, and it's actually the logarithm of that ratio. So think of this as basically the logarithm of the columns normalized for this display purposes. And then you can try different types of shock waves and see what matches the observations. And if you're looking for straight lines here, so which would be constant temperature slabs of gas or a constant temperature shock, then it would be a straight line on this diagram. And you can see that depending on where you look on HH1 and 2, you get a different temperature. There is no standard temperature involved, depends basically on where you look. But they were only observing the strongest, maybe we're observing the bow shocks and particular shocks with those slits I showed you. The ISO offered us another opportunity, and to observe the rotational lines, to observe not just the strong shocks, but to observe all the excited molecules that are there. And the idea here is that we might now be observing the actual turbulence and not just those bow shocks itself. It hasn't come out very clear. There are several. This is Cepheus A, east and west. Here is where the ISO aperture was in our observations, and there are several bow shocks here. Here's a much more turbulent region, and Hartigan has just got a picture out of this. It was in one Astronomy Now magazine on the front page, I think, which really shows an incredible amount of turbulence in this region. I couldn't print that out on the printer before I... Yeah. Here, yeah, filament sheets and disordered, yeah. Okay, and just to say, also you see the CO beam here, which, because we observe these rotational lines at a few microns, and that's the aperture for that. Therefore, another instrument observed at a 100 micron region, and so we also can observe the CO molecule at 100 micron and get extra data, but it's in a larger aperture. So bit more difficult to interpret. Okay. Now, but we have that data, and we can try just fitting it with a hydrodynamic shock, or called a J-type shock, a jump shock. So you have the jump, and then you have, after that, the cooling region in which we see the molecules. It has time to cool after the shock, heat of the molecules. So what we have here, as I just showed in the top diagram, is the molecular hydrogen. And now it only goes, well, up to 10,000 Kelvin here. As I said, it's mainly these rotational lines we're observing with ISO. And again, this CDR, the same as before, the logarithm of it. And so you can see here there's a whole lot of low excitation gas we see in the molecular hydrogen. And that can't be fitted by an ordinary jump shock, which has a lot of high excitation gas here, but very little at the low excitation end. We also then try to model the CO at the same time with exactly the same model. And, well, we can't get a good fit there either. So this is with an individual shock, and that doesn't work. So we need some kind of shock configuration. In fact, there are various models, and I'll just show the top models there. None of them seem to work very well with the ISO data at all, which is not surprising, seeing as the actual images seem to show such shock structures, complicated shock structures. The nearest which gets there is actually the C-Bow model, which is a Bow-type shock, so you do have a shock configuration. I didn't say
Yes, but then it depends on the shape of the bow that you choose. And with these models, simple models I made here, take a C-type shock physics. As I said, these shocks appear to be resolved. They're not J-type anyway. They're not hydrodynamic. The magnetic field is broadening them quite a lot, so they become like a constant temperature slabs of gas is what they stimulate quite closely too. The C-type shock, remember, is this shock is affected by antipolar diffusion, so the magnetic field is cushioning it, and by holding back the ions, by holding back the ions, so they drift through the neutrals, and then the molecules only heat it through the ion neutral friction, and so it's a much softer shock, it's spread out over a much larger region, which is reasonable for what we think this gas is, because we don't expect there to be many ions around there. It's mainly a neutral molecular gas we have there. So we can have the drift between the ions and the neutrals. Okay, so what we really want to do is to know what we would expect from supersonic turbulence. Something I've wanted to know for a long time. And I wrote in a paper just 3 years ago, this is impossible. There's no chance of being able to write about supersonic magnetohydrodynamic turbulence. And then, sitting with Mordecai Maklow, we decided to actually do it. And so we did these 3D simulations. I'm sure Mordecai has shown you, and you've probably seen at the conference, he had the poster up, which basically showed some of our simulations. Here I show one of them. This is decaying turbulence to begin with here, three-dimensional. I just show slabs here at four different times. So 3D box with periodic boundary conditions. No magnetic field in this one. The Mach number begins, the root mean square Mach number at the beginning is 50, with this sort of Gaussian distribution. Okay, up to k equals 8 or something, the wave number of 8. And then we just let that go and see what happens to it. So we put in the Gaussian velocity distribution, uniform density. And look at the same slab, cut through at four different times. What you see here is not that much difference. The shocks form, and then they tend to stay there. But it is decaying. The only reason you don't see much difference there is the scaling here. The scaling is just to show all the convergent waves. This shows just simply all the, basically are all shocks, as you can see from here, but it's just showing all of them there. If you just look at the strongest, it looks very different. You then actually notice that this is hydrodynamic in this case. The field is not there as yet. If you just look at the stronger one, so the scaling there goes up to 50 in the units, the non-dimensionalized units for the computation, you then actually see that there is a strong decay, a fast decay in the strong shocks. So what actually happens, what that tells us is that you're not actually losing shocks, they're just becoming weaker. You have keep the same number of total shocks, it's just that the stronger shocks are slowly becoming weaker. Yes? The initial condition, isotropic?
Barotropic.
No. Yeah. It's isothermal, no conduction, only artificial viscosity plus numerical viscosity in the shocks. Yes. Right. Yeah. The time unit is L upon U. So L is actually the size of the box is 2L, and
the sound speed is 0.1 of U. And so the Rumi square Mach number is 50 in this experiment. So that's how that looks. And just, we've also done the driven case, and it's interesting to see how the driven turbulence looks. This is actually, I did it differently for this. It's the, I've integrated through the cube this time. When I say driven, this is actually uniform driven turbulence. So it keeps, we inject energy with the Gaussian, like we did in decaying, and then we continue to inject with the same Gaussian on k, here's k equals 1 to 2. So that's what's giving that large structure there. That
this is driven by...
Yeah. There's very few modes actually in this calculation here. Actually, just show the columns here. It's not really what I'm interested in, the columns, the gas. But I put it in there just to show that for comparison. If you look at the shocks, by just lines through the through this cube of data, you can find out where it's converging along the x-axis, and you can call that a shock wave, every convergent region, and then you rely on statistics to make sure that you are counting basically all the shocks, or that you have a good idea that you are getting the right distribution of shocks that you're counting. That's what I show here. But if you do simply look at all the converging regions in the three dimensions, so all the shocks, that's this picture here, you can see there are quite some big differences between the two in certain regions, depending on the shock angle, for example, if the shock was exactly along in the x-plane, then it might not be in this show up here. Okay, and just the strong shocks, you can see that most of the strong shocks are actually where the you have the highest density in this large structure that is getting there. Just the convergence. Yeah, well, negative, yes. Here we've got a negative divergence again. Not negative divergence, the negative velocity gradient. So the converging region, the negative delta V summed up. Yes. That is true. That is, yes, that is absolutely true. And so you have to be careful there of whether you really have a shock or not. And if it's if you have a very strong convergence, then I'm pretty certain it's quite safe that it's going to be a shock there. And you're crashing the fluid together at high speed, faster than the speed of sound. It's very difficult to get to make a vortex out of that.
Yeah, but I'm expecting a lot more than shocks.
Sorry, you expect?
I'm expecting
a lot more than
shocks.
That. It. Yeah, in. I don't think so, but it's a good point. Better think about that a bit more. Yes. Right. Yes, I mean, there are also a lot of converging waves there which will be shocks. But you should be able to separate out just by taking the strongest regions, where you apply some minimum to the delta V per zone. But
Also, you have to be careful that the way the Zeus code works, of course, is that each converging, whether it's converging in any direction, it will actually convert energy as though it's a shock. And I know the Zeus code works very well, so I would presume that there... Okay. I think what you say there is true, because the Y and Z convergent regions there will change the intensity levels of all these shocks. So you would expect there to be quite a lot of variation between them, anyway, for that reason, depending on the angle of the shocks there. Okay. We've also done that with self-gravity, which doesn't show much, so I'll just try and push on a little now. So we've done this shock counting, using this by counting them up in the x direction, and because you have often a million shocks involved, we think the statistics will be quite good. And what we find then is for the decaying turbulence, instead of plotting, and also because in the numerical simulations it's very hard to calculate the absolute velocity of the shock, you have to not the absolute strength of the shock, so it's very difficult to calculate. There you need to have to look at it, each part of a shock front in three dimensions, and you would also have to know where the front of the shock is, where the rear of the shock is. It becomes an enormously difficult calculation. But it's easy to know the velocity difference across the shock. So that's what a plot here. Actually plot the jump Mach number, not the jump in the velocity across the shock, but the jump in the Mach number. Mach number is something much more, it's a non-dimensionalized quantity, it's always better to take. And so here we have the probability distribution function for the number of shocks. The number of shocks per unit jump velocity, you can see that as. And that's the initial, at a time 0.5 up to a time of 5. And the amazing thing here was the formula which the data seem to follow, and the data is of course the wiggly lines, and the analytical formula is the straight lines, and that is simply a very simple exponential, e to the minus the velocity and the time. So it's a remarkably simple description of decaying supersonic turbulence. Actually it is what you might expect with the velocity gradients in Burgers type turbulence are exponential. The probability distribution functions of velocity are usually Gaussian, and velocity gradients are exponential. So it's not such a big surprise, actually. And actually look at the power, where the power of the shocks is going to come out. And you see, because it was an exponential distribution in shocks, most of it's coming out at very low Mach numbers. And as the shock decays, where it's coming out, the Mach number, where the power is coming out, actually goes to lower Mach numbers also. So I've got if you're interested, I can show you the MHD case, which you can see the waves, the shocks transverse and parallel to the field. Or I can just simply jump straight away to the driven case. And there you don't have an exponential, you have a power law. So that was an exponential which decayed, exponential in velocity and time, you notice. That's the way that was. For driven, you very quickly reach an equilibrium. As you can see here, the time is 1.5. Do I have the other times on there? I don't have any of the other times. But it shows you that
several times here, and you can see that it very quickly reaches this a power law spectra with a very sharp exponential, e to the minus the jump velocity cubed down here. Okay, and the straight line is actually the analytical fit I show up here. Is that should be right? I'm showing the right thing. Yeah, okay, that's 128 cubed. This shows the minus 1/2 power law. So, driven turbulence, or uniform driven turbulence at least, seems to produce a minus 1/2 power law for whatever energy input we put in there. The question is, how general is this result on the minus 1/2 power law? Well, what I've been doing, if I can jump to my end. What I've been doing while here is running this simulation, in which instead of just putting in the low wave numbers, k equals 1 to 8, is what we've done so far, I put in wave numbers between 32 and 64. And this is only 256 cubed, so I'm putting in a lot of very small waves there, all between k equals 32 and k equals 64, and it tends to fill up the grid with a lot of almost noise-like structure. What I was finding, as it was slowly spewing out the results, was not a minus 1/2 law. Actually, this is the initial distribution, shock distribution, and then it's slowly getting steeper with time. And this is where I got this morning, and now it's down to not minus 1/2 power law, but minus 0.38. So I'm not sure whether this is going to converge to the minus 1/2 again. I can tell you in a few days' time there. There's also this strange bump which is slowly disappearing here. I'm not sure what that is due to at all. Yeah. So, let me just... Now we can actually do what I wanted to do for a long time. What we can do, as I said, we've got the number distributions for the shocks. I should also say, I tried, first of all, a few years ago, with no other thing to do, try putting in a Kolmogorov spectrum. That simply means each vortex, it'll crash upon itself, create a shock, and so basically you end up, because it's Kolmogorov, the energy dissipation at each velocity is constant. That produces the Kolmogorov steady state spectra. And when you do that, you end up something very similar to a paraboloidal bow shock in the distribution of shocks that you have. It's basically the power goes logarithmically with the jump velocity. And so it produced a much too hotter spectrum. We couldn't explain the ISO data with that. But, so, now the truth is that it's not anything like the Kolmogorov. It is actually much steeper, and it does match the Cepheus-A ISO data. But because it's decaying turbulence, it depends on what time you look at it. So I show it here three times. And so again, it's that same data, the molecular hydrogen, that's column density ratio against the transition energy. And at the early time, you still have a very hot gas here, which doesn't fit this rotational line here. At a time t equals 1, then just so happens it fits the data quite nicely, the best fit that we've been able to manage, which would perhaps suggest that what we are observing in Cepheus-A is decaying turbulence, and we're catching it at a particular moment, especially in that aperture we have there. You could say we're creating a lot of turbulence
It could be driven or it could be decaying. Because if we're driving it with a jet, and then we observe where we're driving it, then you would expect it to be driven, of course. But if we're driving it with a jet or with a bullet, and then we stop it, then it would just decay. And then we drive it another bullet, and it just decays again. So it could be either. And what this seems to be saying here is that we're catching the turbulence around this time t equals 1. And if we looked at this later, Cepheus A would slowly be fading. And whether it fades or not, we'll have to either wait and see or try and observe this in different positions and see if there's some gradual transition as you move away from the jet, for example. Then that would really prove it's decaying turbulence. But this shows that it is consistent with a decaying turbulence. For the driven case, well, actually, it doesn't make that much difference. You can actually fit it with the driven turbulence also. Remember, these curves could have come in any direction. They could have come out like that. But the curves are, in the right general sense, with a right sort of curvature to at least explain the low temperature gas, which is what we looks like in the images as the turbulent gas. It could be that these high temperature component here and this strange high temperature component in the CO gas could be directly from the bow shocks itself, directly where the jet's hitting. That seems to be a separate component. That is my guess there. But with driven, we don't have the time sequence, of course. We only have one per simulation, which here is the energy input. If you have a high energy input, you get a higher excitation spectrum. Low energy, then you have this low excitation spectrum. And the major point here is if I can keep it in my head, which is now just gone out of my head. Sorry. Probably won't find the notes now, where I'm up to there. Yeah, that's right. The reason this thing seems to work is I think now clear. What we need actually is an exponential distribution of shocks. The distribution function was about right. Because with the hydrogen molecules, they say when it's in thermodynamic equilibrium, the levels, the columns, have an exponential distribution, e to the minus tj upon t. Where Tj is that upper transition and T is the temperature of the gas. So now, if you also have an exponential distribution of shocks, then you have some, you introduce another exponential, but it'll be the other way up. It'll, for example, the exponential distribution in the number would go e to the minus v squared, some constant in there. But if the velocity of the shocks is some power law, as it is with power law with the temperature here, the V squared might then go as something like T to the fourth power or T to the fifth power in there, which is quite high actually when I think about it. But what I was trying to say here is that when you have two exponentials cancelling, they can basically cancel each other out, and that can then produce a highly curved line. If one of these exponentials dominated, you would then have a straight line and you can't match any of the data. But we always see curves in the column density ratio. There always are these very strongly curved lines. And I think the reason for that curvature is that the shocks are actually distributed exponentially. It's the natural way. That's the only way you can get rid of this high exponential dependence, is by producing another exponential. And what's happening in the driven turbulence, because I said that's a power law, is that the power law is not controlling anything. It's that exponential tail at the end there, where after the power law section, it has an exponential tail of shocks. And it, again, it's that exponential tail which is dominating things. The power law doesn't matter at all. it's only this exponential tail which can actually affect what you're seeing there. Sorry. Yes. I mean, yes. Yeah. If you look, yes. If you look at this tail right in here, where the temperatures, the higher velocity shocks, and those temperatures, that's going to be the most important part of it there. It also depends on the shock physics, I should say here. The velocity, how the temperature of a shock is related to the velocity depends on the actual shock physics you use. I've been using the C-types, the ambipolar diffusion physics in here to produce this. If I use the J-type shocks, it would also not work. The excitation would be too strong, I believe. Well, I haven't done that yet. As I said, it's still ongoing work here. Okay. I said, we've also got some explanations for the exponential law in terms of mapping closure, and we've also got an explanation for the power law in terms of the shock dynamics and the fact that the shock spectrum seems to be controlled by these few, seem to be controlled by this, at the knee there are strong shocks. And then you have the power law, is because you have a lot of little weak shocks which tend to get destroyed or weakened when a strong shock comes along. You can then explain that that would produce that power law to the minus a half. So we have some interpretation of what's going on here, but there's a lot more in those formula I showed there which we haven't thought about yet. And the only other way with observing shocks through turbulence would be with masers. We can also observe, they actually observe what they think is supersonic turbulence by observing, you know, hundreds of masers in a small region. And then they have the proper motion velocities and radial velocities. And that's another thing, we have the data right here to be able to try and model that. It'd be interesting then to see if those are actually being produced by supersonic turbulence also. But anyway, I think shocks is a good alternative to testing supersonic turbulence theories. Any more questions? My best guess is there's a disk instability. There's a type of thermal iron instability in the disk, and so it tends to build up in the inner regions, and then how does it actually throw out that gas? I don't know if, are you talking about that? Someone was talking about the disk. Okay, maybe not. Yeah. But I think with the thermal instability, you build up the mass in the disk, and then it becomes optically thick. I think that is the point. And then the temperature goes way up, and that gives the outburst. And then you basically have the inner disk is then missing, and over another 1,000 years it builds up in mass, and then the same thing happens again. And that happens only if you have accretion rates above a few times 10 to the minus 7, I think, solar masses per year. So in some cases you wouldn't expect that to happen. If you're just very, very steadily accrete gas, then you would avoid the bullets. If you try accreting fast, then you have this optical depth effect and instability. Yep. Spatial distribution of gas at a particular temperature, yes.
No. Not as yet. Why not? Now, why not is hard to say. We're originally for one of these outflows, we actually observed sort of a wave-like structure spectroscopy with observing the line profile through one of these outflows, and you can see the variations in there as though it's a wave moving, shifted one way and then back again. So I think that's the nearest that we've actually gotten to that. But I guess you can also observe the whole profile there from one emission line profile from the whole region. Try to test that. I guess that's something which could simply be now done using these models to predict the actual profile shapes. Yeah, that's true, which could be very different from the Gaussians, which you'd expect now from the CO line. Can get the Gaussians or some structure on or whatever. From the shocks itself, it might give something completely different. It might could even give a power law line profiles, wings to the line profiles. So that would be interesting to see, actually. Yes. The mazes into context. There seems to be the mazes seem to be occurring from some kind of cocoon, from some edge there, and with bow shocks, with these eruptions produced in these bullets in here, and you often see the mazes also around there. That's the impression I have. So you can see little arc-type structures in the mazes, as well as edges like that. And I think that's where the large-scale structure we see in the mazes is coming from.
That would be a relatively narrow opening angle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. That is true. Some do have quite a large opening angle. I'm not sure about OMC one. I can't remember that. I mean, that's curious.
Jet
there, is there? It's just such a mess. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. What Carl Gwynne was also showing was that these individual regions seem to have a lot of, can have 100 mazes in each individual region, which he thinks is some type of supersonic turbulence because of the different directions they have and the different velocities. So that's the sort of thing which you should try modeling with these distributional shocks, or mean with the simulations and seeing.
That would be the angle of essence.
Yeah. And several, like HH212, for example, has an opening angle of 20 degrees or so for the mazes. You actually see the mazes in there. And that's 20 to 30 degrees, I seem to remember, is about right for that opening angle.
Last year's
I think so. The angular momentum. The angular. Yeah, the, I can show you the data. Right. And how can I? Yeah, we need to do more observations to actually see if we actually have observed it or not. But I can just show you. You can tell me. This is probably it's the first evidence for it. I guess is the way I put it there. But these were the knots itself. So this HH212, the image. This is the actual image here. So you can see the inner knots going north and the inner knots going south there. So we get three slits there across the here, as you can see, and then we show the spectrum of those three slits, the position velocity diagram. So here we've got the velocity. So the first thing then is you can see here we have this acceleration as you go out in that direction, and here you can see the opposite acceleration in that direction. Okay, so that's the blue shifted and that's the red shifted. Yep. And then across here, -4.9, -5.5, -3.8, which was not very good. This is the point which goes against what we're saying. Which is the really good systematic velocity change is across here, from 6.3 to 4.6 to 4.0. Oh. So in other words, the velocity here is, don't get confused, is more redshifted, and so you have that redder on this side, bluer on this side, basically. And it also holds for these other knots up there, I think for the inner six knots, except for this point. This point should be -6 or -7 if what I was saying was absolutely true. This one is wrong. And you can try to explain it away, it's on the edge, it's observing the background gas. Or you can say it's not.
How about further up then?
But further up? We go from -7 to -9. There we don't have anything. Well, we have to reobserve this again.
But
there,
you have the, I don't have the number, but you have the data.
We have something there. That's true. There is something. That's a good point. And there is something there as well. I don't know. I don't know about that. It's not enough. It's not enough to make a claim we have observed it. But it's a, I think we, if we do look at it again in more detail, that will really tell us
about it. Those differences, would they be compatible with capillary rotation in the disk?
There is an if 10% of the mass is there is the disk, you see. And my calculation, the answer is yes. This is the ammonia disk. No, that's sort of linear what you see there. But you're seeing the disk almost edge on. And the whole system, the jets are in the plane of the sky, you're seeing it almost edge on. So what I've done. What I did for the calculation is simply to try to presume it's basically Keplerian across here. So at this scale of 10 to the 16 centimeters, it has a velocity shift of 0.2 kilometers a second per 1,000 AU, something like that. 0.2 of a kilometer a second per. Sorry?
0.2 is much less.
That's right. Which means that, but if 10% of the mass is being ejected and it's carrying away all the angular momentum, you're then at the right level. You're then back to the right level.
Well, that you wouldn't expect, I mean, the projected velocity would expect to be the same, wouldn't you? Yeah, you were saying.
If only 10% of the mass is ejected, then it has to carry away all the angular momentum.
It has to speed up, you mean, or what?
Yes.
They have velocity here, and then you have velocity, and then you have your outflow somehow. There's a certain oblique angle, and you say the velocity here must be 10 times bigger than here. I mean,
it's being the beads on the string. You eject a small amount of mass, and it carries away all the angular momentum.
Yes.
And then it's consistent with that disk there.
Yeah, but no, I mean, would the angular... Okay, right. Yeah, the angular momentum must then... So then then you can work out the angular momentum at this place.
Yes.
And can trace this back to the position where it actually came from.
Yes, that's right.
Right, I mean, if you assume that you're 2 kilometers per second or something.
And then it has to come from... or 100 AU, that was 1,000. I think it has to then come from about 100 AU, I think, which is still quite large. Is it 100 AU or 10 AU? It has to still come from quite a large, it has to take up all that angular momentum from still quite a large region, not from that disk, but from a factor of 10 smaller. Which is then the next problem, because you have to extract that angular momentum from that scale, which is, say, 10 to the 15 centimeters. But at 10 to the 15 centimeters, velocities tend to be low, and it's very hard to drive a wind from that scale. We really want the wind to be driven from right of the stellar surface, you know, within 1 AU at least, get some power out with it. But it seems to be taking away all the angular momentum from within perhaps 100 AU out with it. How is that possible then? Right, yeah. I think you're right. And then the only way this could then work is if somehow you were getting the mass in there, you're loading it. So you're having some low velocity wind out here, trying to carry away all the angular momentum from the disk, and then an inner jet coming and sweeping it up and carrying away that angular momentum. Yeah. Yes, for one thing. So you don't believe it. But there's another way, actually, of getting a lot of angular momentum in the jet. And that is you twist up the magnetic field lines. So actually, you don't have the angular momentum in the jet. It's just that the field lines get twisted. When you drive this shock, the switch shock, so you're driving a shock along field lines, you tend to twist the magnetic field automatically. And because you twist the magnetic field automatically, that means the field, the fluid itself, has to be carrying the angular momentum in the other direction, or basically along those field lines. You twist up the field lines and you make the fluid twist also. And that's what we could be observing, rather than the actual angular momentum from this. This is what I'm thinking, because you actually observe shocks there. So these are shocks coming out along field lines, and the field lines don't like it because of this switch type MHD behavior. So the field lines get bent like that, and the fluid then starts to rotate. Right, I want to try and model that, because I think that's an exciting idea also, if that's correct. I'm sure there are a lot of ways of doing this. Yeah. I mean, one thing I wanted to do directly is with the jet. Just simply put in the jet there, get all the turbulence, see what that turbulence is. That's one thing. And the other thing is a spatial term. Then you get the space with distance from the jet also. And then we'll be able to see how the turbulence can propagate. Maybe we can do that with UCAF. Are you involved? You're still at Newcastle, really, aren't you, Axel? So, yeah. So you'll be using UCAF then, aren't you?
I am. I think I'm involved with UCAF.
Sorry?
I'm not sure. I think I am, yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Because we're thinking of getting together and having sort of one really big simulation to start it off with. So something with turbulence,
yeah,
we could easily do. That would be, as I said, I've only done these two types of really isotropic, isothermal turbulence here. And there's a lot of other different types. That's right, that's right. Do the mazes and everything with it, maybe. For the show.
Not for the show, but...
It could be that Cepheus A, I mean, I think basically you're saying that the high mass outflows,
mm-hmm.
like DR21, for example, is also quite a wide looking structure.
DR21?
Yeah, DR21.
This is a really good
labor. DR21, Cepheus A. Same sort of graph. What other one? The wide, the one in the field, which could be one like that. I'm not sure. I think it's 202. No, it's so many numbers. I'll look it up if I get it.
Yeah, just do that. And they give you the paper and you see in which context they do it, but there are some conceptual. I think the outflow is probably
okay. Mm-hmm.
I'll give you a copy.
Yes, that's great.